I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
This episode is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink, inspiring public curiosity about food. Learn more at mofad.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, we are celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we are just getting started. Find us at heritageradio.org.
Good evening, and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liute, and we're broadcasting from Roberta's on Heritage Radio Network. The Renewable Fuel Standard, in short, is a federal policy that requires biofuels to be blended with American gasoline. It's also an example of an environmental policy that, while well-intentioned, may be one that turns out hasn't proven itself to be all that great for reducing greenhouse gases. Today, we're going to learn what exactly the Renewable Fuel Standard is, what its impact on agriculture and the environment has been since its inception, and why it's already proving itself to be a hot-button issue for the 2020 election. Joining me to discuss today is Michael Grunwald, journalist and author of The New Deal, The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era. His recent article, How the 2020 Democrats Learned to Love Ethanol, was published this week in Political Magazine, and I'm so pleased it's brought him to the show today. Welcome to Eating Matters, Michael.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Okay, so before we kind of jump right in and into this topic and learn all about the Renewable Fuel Standard, which I feel like I need to just abbreviate right off the bat. It's like a mouthful. But anyway, what made you decide to write about this? Because I would say it's not necessarily clickbait.
You know, it's funny. As embarrassing as it may sound, ethanol has been one of my obsessions for quite a long time. And in fact, after this article ran, I saw somebody tweeted like, "Oh, it's Grunwald's quadrennial, you know, flag at the ethanol industry. It's like as much an Iowa tradition as the butter cow and the state fair." I think if you do care about climate change, mm-hmm. And I do write a lot about climate change, corn ethanol and biofuels in general has been a really undercovered aspect of the quandary we're in and the sometimes fakakta ways we're trying to get out of it.
Yeah. Okay. Absolutely. And that's why I'm so excited to have you to kind of unpack it with us today, because I think people, you know, hear a lot. I think they think ethanol, it's so good, but nobody really knows a lot about this policy. So can you just like break it down really simply? Like, what is the Renewable Fuel Standard? When was it introduced and what does it entail?
Sure. I mean, renewable fuels sound great, right?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, most of us know that we have this real fossil fuel problem that gasoline creates, emits carbon into the atmosphere, and those greenhouse gases are what's broiling the planet. Mm-hmm. So we need alternatives to that. And the Renewable Fuel Standard was sort of there's been federal government subsidies and programs to promote ethanol for quite a while, initially, and the main reason has always been to help farmers, because pretty much all agricultural policy in Washington is about helping farmers. You know, there are spectacular subsidies, there's crop insurance. Ethanol was seen as another way, and so there were originally subsidies for that in 2005, and then it was expanded in 2007. Mm-hmm. There was this idea, well, we're going to mandate a certain amount of gallons to be blended of ethanol to be blended into into gasoline every year, which will create this automatic market. And it'll really encourage people, it'll encourage farmers to grow corn for the biofuels market, which right now 40% of the corn grown in the United States is to feed our SUVs rather than ourselves. And at the time, it was also seen as a way to reduce our dependence on foreign oil, which is less of a problem today. But so it wasn't like people were really thinking about climate change much, but certainly the idea that it was a renewable fuel, it was going to help farmers, and it was going to mean less gasoline were all seen as good things.
And then the definition of ethanol, just to be super clear, what is the definition of ethanol?
Baseline. Oh, man. I mean, we're talking, it's ethyl alcohol.
Okay.
But essentially, it's a, it's a kind of gasoline, it's a fuel that's brewed out of the starch that's in corn. And then there, they don't take the whole corn. There's some left over that they feed to cows and other animals. But essentially, they grow corn, they blend it into gasoline. Right now, you hear a lot about E15, which means it can be up to 15% ethanol in your gasoline, and it increases the octane. But essentially, it's a way of, the more ethanol you have, the less gasoline you need. And that's, was seen as
a good thing.
Renewable alternative. And like, hey, that's great.
Right. And then is all renewable fuel considered to be ethanol, or are there other kinds of fuels?
That's a great question. So even before people were freaking out about climate change, there was this recognition that as a way of getting alternatives to gasoline, that corn ethanol, that it seems kind of weird to be growing corn just for the, to produce fuel, that seemed maybe not the most efficient way of doing things, especially since there are 800 million hungry people on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
By increasing the price of grain, you're increasing these food insecurity problems. And in fact, after the renewable fuel standard was expanded in 2007, it created a real price spike. And in 2008, you saw, I think there were 38 countries had food riots. Like there were the tortilla riots in Mexico. There was, a lot of instability in places like Pakistan and Sudan that were not exactly tranquil before.
Right.
So I think people were starting to realize that, wow, there were really unintended consequences. The original idea was that corn ethanol would be this kind of bridge fuel, that by having the renewable fuel standard, right now they're brewing ethanol, but ultimately they'll be making biofuels out of, say, switchgrass or algae.
Mm-hmm.
There are all kinds of cool ideas, some of which I wrote about in my book, and that you mentioned in 2012, the New New Deal.
Mm-hmm.
The Obama stimulus had created a lot of biorefineries, most of them to try to create these, they call them advanced biofuels or second generation biofuels. They're sort of ways to create alternatives to gasoline that don't require corn.
But for now, most of them require, when we're talking about ethanol, it's like corn based.
Yeah. Well, the punchline that I was, that I kind of buried the lead, is that so far advanced biofuels have been a total bust.
Okay.
They were a great idea. I wrote about them perhaps maybe a little bit credulously in my book.
Mm-hmm.
I went and visited a very cool startup in San Francisco that was, it looked like a little brewery, except they were basically trying to brew fuel. I went to a place near me in Florida where they were trying to turn trash into fuel. All very cool ideas. None of them have really worked very well. And so far, the renewable fuel standards is every year it mandates about 15 billion gallons of corn ethanol. And then the rest is supposed to be some mix of biofuels. But they have to kind of waive the requirements every year for the advanced stuff because it just isn't happening.
Okay, so it's pretty much corn. I don't know why I always thought soybeans was in the mix, too.
There is a little bit of that. There's some soy biodiesel. And then I shouldn't completely trash the idea, and we'll talk more about the climate aspects, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But there also is, like, I'm sure you've heard about area, like, you know, some restaurant where they turn their grease into a kind of fuel.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that. That, like, you know, that counts. But it's just sort of hasn't reached, you know, it's not the kind of scale where we're talking about. I mean, think about 40% of the corn that's grown in right. the United States. And we're talking about, like, millions of acres dedicated to growing fuel. That's, you know, that's more than the, you know, the grease they're going to, you know, get out of the back of the restaurant.
Yes, that is true. And so, I mean, talking kind of about scale, what do we, when we say, you know, requiring ethanol to be mixed with gasoline, how much ethanol and what kind of like percentage of the overall output of fuel does it entail? If that makes sense.
So we're talking about 15 billion gallons right now.
Wow.
Of corn ethanol every year, and this year there was so President Trump has been he made all kind of promises to the ethanol industry when he ran in 2016 because he wanted to win Iowa, mm-hmm. Which has that's been the one real theme of ethanol, is that presidential candidates of both parties have come down to Iowa every 4 years and they talk about how great ethanol is, no matter what they've said about ethanol in the past.
Yeah.
And Trump was one of those people. But he's maintained the renewable fuel standard at the status quo, which is what the corn industry wants. So they're happy about that. But his first EPA head was Scott Pruitt, mm-hmm. who everybody remembers because he was sort of spectacularly corrupt and just terrible EPA administrator all around.
Which is saying a lot in this administration
When it came to ethanol, it was interesting because he was a very severe critic of the ethanol industry.
Yeah.
Now, it will come as no shock to any of your listeners that this was not because he was really concerned about the environmental aspects
right.
of ethanol.
Yeah.
It was because he is a shill for the fossil fuel industry, for petroleum.
Mm-hmm.
They bankrolled all his campaigns in Oklahoma, and so basically he was their kind of killer in Washington. And so what he did was he granted all kinds of exemptions from the renewable fuel standards for all kinds of refineries, and that actually, you know, even like refineries owned by Exxon, you know, they pleaded some kind of, you know,
exemption.
And they got exemptions.
Yeah.
And so that actually reduced the actual amount. And the ethanol industry is actually doing quite badly right now, partly because of those exemptions.
So let's take a step back. Okay, so then just before, I want to get into kind of like how it works and who the major stakeholders are, but just how is this supposed to contribute to a reduction in greenhouse gas? Like, what was the original theory behind it all?
So that's great. So again, it sounds like, you know, sort of great for the climate, right? Because you've got, you know, you've got corn ethanol, where
it's natural,
obviously, right? It's renewable, and it is renewable. You know,
in a way,
you burn it in your car,
yeah.
But then you grow more corn, and the act of growing corn sucks carbon out of the atmosphere, photosynthesis, and then of course you take that carbon and burn it again, but then you grow more corn
and
more carbon out of the atmosphere.
Yeah.
So again, so people sort of said like it's basically carbon neutral, and yeah, you know, there's some, you know, then also you probably have to factor in like, you know, how much fossil fuel you have to run your tractor and stuff like that. But basically said like, oh, well, you know, maybe it's got a little bit of a carbon impact, but it's way better than gasoline. And then I think you mentioned Tim Serchinger, who I think has been on your show.
Mm-hmm.
He was really the first to kind of realize, well, wait a minute. It's not like they're growing that corn on what used to be pavement. They're growing that corn on what used to be a cornfield.
Right.
So it was already taking carbon out of the atmosphere. Now we're just burning it. And
yeah.
If we're going to take an acre of corn to grow fuel, then somewhere else we're going to have to take another acre to grow corn for food. And it's probably not going to come from a parking lot either. It's probably going to come either from a forest or a grassland or a wetland that was already storing a lot more carbon than a cornfield can. Mm-hmm. So ultimately what they kind of realized was that the whole thing was a mistake, and that these that corn ethanol is actually even worse for the climate than gasoline, because essentially it takes up land that we need to either grow food or store carbon, and it uses it to very inefficiently grow fuel.
Right. And his whole thing from he was a lead author for listeners who, have listened to that episode. He was lead author of the Creating a Sustainable Food Future report from the World Resources Institute. And I think the whole point of the report, and correct me if I'm wrong, is like, or one of the big takeaways is like, we cannot clear any more land for food production or kind of for anything.
And one statistic that, and I hope I don't mangle it, but I'm pretty sure it's that if we devoted the entire U.S. grain crop to fuel, it would only meet about 20% of our transportation fuel needs.
Yeah.
And when you think about that, it's like, oh, and then we wouldn't have any food.
This is
probably not the way to go.
Right. There's got to be a better way.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's one of the environmental issues. And I think there are a couple more, right? That's like a big takeaway. But in terms of, is there anything else that people point to and they're like, well, this did not work the way we wanted it to in terms
of
how?
I think it's really the land use. One of the implications of that, and it is true that, using switchgrass for biofuels, that would be, that is better than corn ethanol, because, as I mentioned, corn does have some other, you use fertilizer, and that's petroleum based, and you have a tractor, you have to take,
it requires a lot of inputs,
grain to market, and all these, things that may. But then you realize, like, switchgrass has that same land problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, if it was switchgrass, maybe it should just stay in switchgrass, or maybe it should be a forest. Or maybe it should be a cornfield that produces food. But certainly it turns out that land is really good at storing carbon and really good at growing food.
Mm-hmm.
But land is very bad at growing fuel. Fossil fuels are really awesome at producing fuel. It turns out that electric vehicles are really good at making cars go.
Mm-hmm.
But photosynthesis is an extremely inefficient way of using the power of the sun. It kind of launders the sun's energy, as opposed to solar panels, which really kind of directly convert it into energy we can use. And so it turns out that photosynthesis is better at turning that sun's energy into stuff that powers us, not so much our vehicles.
Yeah. Well, and you write about, this article focused a lot on Iowa, and, I want to ask why, if that's just kind of from politically speaking with the upcoming election. But before I ask that, you say that wind now provides more than a third of Iowa's electricity. That was very surprising to me, because Iowa seems to be like ground zero of ethanol production.
Well, again, remember, we're talking about, so electricity is coal, natural gas, and now increasingly wind and solar. That's sort of a different competition than transportation fuels, which you're talking more about oil,
mm-hmm.
Which goes, gets converted into gasoline. So Iowa is just kind of a windy place, just like, other fossil fuel places like Texas and Oklahoma have also been huge leaders in the wind industry. But part of the point there is that you'd think in 2020, you've got a wind industry that's way bigger than the ethanol industry in Iowa,
mm-hmm.
even though Iowa has the nation's largest ethanol industry. But so far that hasn't really translated politically. Ethanol and again, corn, the ethanol lobby is identical to the corn lobby, and the corn lobby is really quite powerful in Iowa, but also nationally, because it's really, it's farmers.
So what, in terms of like the industry players, because there's a lot of, there's been a lot of kind of controversy between the different, like, who are the lobbyists? There's like a lot of lobbyists. It's refiners versus producers. And can, you know, there's like a, been a lot of back and forth credits. Can you just kind of give us a, an overall perspective on?
I mean, you're right. It does get a little really complicated, but it's most, it's mostly pretty simple. I mean, the fights over ethanol in Washington are all about, they're about big oil versus tin corn and the rest of the ag industry. You know, the farmers like it because it keeps their, it boosts their prices artificially. The oil guys don't like it because it, it cuts into their profits a bit. And so that's always been the fight. You know, the reason I wrote this story was because this seems like the kind of year that that might change, where you have this combination of really just now the science has become pretty overwhelming about the greenhouse gas implications of corn ethanol in particular. At the same time, you've got climate suddenly emerging for the first time as really, you know, if not the leading issue, at least the a leading issue in the Democratic primary, where all these candidates are racing to show how green they are, and they're all endorsing the Green New Deal, which is describing climate change as this planetary emergency, this existential crisis. You know, and at the same time, you know, Democrats have been doing terrible in the rural areas that really like ethanol.
Right.
You know, Trump won Iowa by 10 points, and while Democrats did really well in 2018 in Iowa, they flipped a couple of congressional seats. It's because they really ran up the score in cities like, you know, Des Moines and Cedar Rapids. They're still getting crushed in the rural areas. So it seemed like the stars were kind of aligned for at least, you figure a few Democrats would say like, hey, you know, if this is a really a planetary emergency, well, you know, maybe I shouldn't be for this mandated renewable fuel that
is backfiring,
doesn't really help the climate and is worse than gasoline and is only helping basically Trump supporters.
Right.
So I thought maybe there would be some movement.
And there hasn't been, right? And I don't even, I'm not even sure that a lot of Democrats are really embracing climate change as like a campaign issue. I still think it's one that people are kind of shying away from. And I, you know, I don't know. I think this election might shape up to be even more about like the economy and jobs than it ever has been. But yeah, I don't know.
Well, I don't think that's what's happened so far. I mean, certainly the Democrats who are in Iowa and, you know, Nevada and South Carolina, they are talking a lot about climate change. Even more than they're talking about the economy, really. And they are all talking about how committed they are. But this is an area where none of them have really, I mean, some like you know, Amy Klobuchar, who is from the Midwest, represents a farm state.
Yeah.
And has always been huge for ethanol, kind of not so surprising.
Right. And she's going to stay there, probably.
Yeah. But then you see, like, you know, and then Bernie Sanders, who used to be a big critic of ethanol when he, you know, when he was just a, you know, kind of
a young
senator from Vermont. Then in 2016, he ran for president, and suddenly he decided that ethanol was really awesome, too.
Yeah.
So I guess it's at least not a surprise that he's still saying that ethanol is really awesome. But even the kind of like, you know, Elizabeth Warren, Michael Bloomberg, when he was running, he had been a huge critic of ethanol, and he has been a spectacular supporter of climate action, who funded the entire Beyond Coal movement. But even him this year, when he was thinking of running for president, he flipped on ethanol. So there's just a lot of pressure.
Yeah. I mean, that actually is somebody who worked for the Bloomberg administration doing food policy work. I read that and like my heart dropped. So why do you think that is, though, with him in particular? He's not running, but he's going to probably be funding a lot of candidates who should have.
Well, he was
voice
running when he said that stuff. I think now I'm sure he regrets it.
Yeah, he's like, just kidding.
He kind of flipped for no reason.
I guess
what Democrats would say is, that they've got a problem in rural America.
Yep,
that's true. They have to get right with these people who hate them. Obama won Iowa by, I think, 6 points, and then Trump won it by 9. So something went really wrong, and what the Democrats seem to have decided is that what went wrong is that rural Americans hated Hillary Clinton, and mm-hmm. somehow they have to fix that, and they seem to think that ethanol is a part of it. I think also then, in fairness, because it's always been the thing to do when you're in Iowa is to, you know, you go out and talk to people who generally, you know, even if it's not their top issue, most Iowans are probably okay with ethanol. And, you know, while the people who care most about ethanol are the farmers and people who are in farm-related industries in Iowa, mm-hmm. while the people who are against it, you know, say the people who care about climate change, ethanol is not their big issue. I mean, they care about, you know, are you for the Green New Deal, or are you for a carbon tax, or are you for doing something? So I think probably a lot of them, you know, I thought what Cory Booker said was very interesting. He said, look, you know, ultimately, I think we can all see there's going to be a transition to electric vehicles. It's a question of when, not if,
right?
And how long it's going to take. But for now, yeah, I'm for ethanol and the farmer. That's kind of what he said.
He's sort of been walking kind of like the middle line on a lot of these issues, including the Green New Deal. But the reason I said, like, I don't know if the environment's going to be front and center is because you start to see, like, you've seen Pelosi and certainly Feinstein this past week or so, really like kind of come out as like the establishment, like we can't go into this. We have to focus on other things. Like the Green New Deal is not realistic. And of course it's not, I mean, it's not even legislation, right? It's like an idea that's floating out there, but.
Well, yeah. And this maybe, I should probably like identify myself before I sort of opine on this, but I'm like I'm a super climate hawk. I have solar panels and an electric vehicle. I'm probably a little bit of a neoliberal shill by Brooklyn standards. And so I think even somebody like me who, like, you know, I had no problem with them saying, we're going to have all renewables in 10 years, which isn't going to happen.
No.
But I think, like, great, but go ahead, say that. That's absolutely great. And I think, you know, I'm all for that. But I do think the idea that this Green New Deal has suddenly means that you're also for, you know, the kind of free college and government mandated, you know, the government gives everybody a job with free vacation and et cetera, that basically that the Green New Deal, as the resolution was written, has become a kind of a wish list for the left, mm-hmm. Defining basically everything that the left wants as an emergency. And some of it I'm for, like, I think there should be universal health care. But that, to me, that's not the emergency. The emergency is that, like, the planet is about to become inhospitable to human life. So I think the idea that presidential candidates who have all said they're for a Green New Deal generally, and Nancy Pelosi, who says she's all for doing stuff on the climate, but the idea that they're not kind of making the Green New Deal as written by AOC and others, making that a, you know, the sort of the hill to die on, I don't think that necessarily reflects a sort of lack of commitment to climate action. And the other thing, and, you know, and sort of President Obama, as I pointed out in my book, mm-hmm. A lot of climate people were sort of like, oh, Obama hasn't done anything. Why? You know, it's terrible.
Yeah.
But in fact, like, just within the first month by passing that stimulus, which poured $90 billion into clean energy, he did arguably more than any human being on the planet has ever done to reduce carbon emissions. I mean, he really, you look, I mean, again, those biorefineries I mentioned, those didn't turn out so great. But the solar industry, the wind industry, the battery industry and LED lighting has all basically, there's been a revolution, and a lot of that is because of the subsidies that were passed in 2009. And so I would expect, you know, the Democrats are going to run on extending that revolution.
I hope so. But I think that, like, I don't think there's been a lot of talk about all of the good that Obama did during his presidency. That statistic you just mentioned, like the $90 billion being poured into clean energy, is, I didn't know that. Not that I'm the barometer for what everybody knows, but, you know. Yeah.
I mean, clearly you need to read the book.
You obviously, I need to get the book. Yes. It's happening.
But I do, and look, this is a big theme of the book. And one of the themes of the book has been that, you know, Obama has fought the right. You know, when he was president, he spent 8 years fighting the right to do stuff. I've wrote about how he actually achieved quite a bit, but the whole time he had the left saying, you haven't done crap, which didn't make it easier to achieve stuff. That said, I think in the, you know, I would just say that the actual Democrats who live in the country there's this kind of debate over, you know, was Obama good on Twitter, like sort of the left on Twitter.
Yeah.
That has very little relationship to the way in the actual country, like 95% of Democrats think Obama was awesome.
Yeah. I'm one of those.
And I would expect that whoever the Democratic nominee is, really, unless it's Bernie Sanders, but there's one reason I don't think it's going to be Bernie Sanders. They're going to run on, like, you know, let's go back to the Obama way. And part of that is going to be, you know, although I think they will say, like, you know, it's a new time and we're going to have to go even farther on climate. But I think the idea that Obama did a clean power plan and Trump has been trying to roll it back, and Obama did big subsidies for renewable energy and Republicans have been rolling that back. I expect you're going to hear all kinds of that stuff.
Okay. We're going to take a really quick commercial break to hear a word from our sponsors. But when we get back, I want to know why you don't think it's going to be Bernie in 2020. And also, you know, whether or not we're in too deep to make a change. Stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. Featuring a variety of interactive displays, MOFAD encourages eaters of all ages to be curious about food. The museum currently operates MOFAD Lab, a 5,000-square-foot experimental space in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where Chow, making the Chinese-American restaurant, is currently on show until the end of March 2019. This exhibition celebrates the birth and evolution of Chinese-American restaurants, tracing their nearly 170-year history, and sparking conversations about food culture, immigration, and what it means to be American. It highlights the evolution timeline of Chinese-American restaurant menus, dating back to 1910, and also highlights a tasting section where participants get to enjoy tastings created by the country's most talented chefs who specialize in Chinese-American cuisine. Make sure you check out Chow while you still can. The exhibition closes at the end of March 2019. Check out MOFAD's tastings and extensive event calendar at mofad.org/events.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Akiko Katayama, and I'm the host of Japan Meets here on HRN. By interviewing fascinating personalities in Japanese culinary culture, I try to demystify Japanese cuisine. My guests have included sake brewers, tea experts, Japanese whiskey experts, and sushi chefs. You can find Japan Meets whenever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
And we're back on Eating Matters, where today I'm speaking with Michael Grunwald, author of The New New Deal, whose recent article, How the 2020 Democrats Learned to Love Ethanol, was just published in Politico magazine. Okay, so before the break, you said you don't think it's going to be Bernie in 2020. And this is like a tiny bit, kind of like a lot tangential, but I just want to know what your thoughts are really quickly.
You asked me to put my Politico magazine hat on.
Yeah.
Look, I think, you know, again, the... You know, Twitter isn't America, and in the country, the thing that most Democrats want most is to win.
Mm-hmm.
And And like Bernie has a very passionate following, but there's no way to argue that, you know, that a socialist is the, you know, is the most electable Democrat. Not that others don't have their, you know, their vulnerabilities as well.
Right.
For me, it's just, it doesn't seem like his moment. I mean, in fairness, it doesn't seem like Joe Biden's moment either.
Right.
And the two of them have been at the top of most of the polls. But I also think right now they're the ones people know. And, yeah. You know, if you ask me to bet, I would bet that it's going to be somebody a lot younger.
I mean, that I think would be a really good thing, although we didn't really go for a centrist in the last election, did we? I mean, that's I think we had a candidate who was pretty center. But anyway, then we got Trump, which has just been a nightmare. So moving on, I want to talk about what we I started to ask before the break. Are we in too deep to make a change? And if we're not, like, what is the situation where the renewable fuel standard gets altered? What would that look like?
Well, it expires in 2022.
Okay. There you go.
So again, like, let's be real. I think it's probably unlikely that it's going to go from the current, you know, 36 billion gallons or whatever it is overall to zero.
Mm-hmm.
I think, look, I know your show is about food writ large, and I think a lot of the people who are doing work on ethanol, but also on agriculture and on the entire food system, are trying to think of ways that globally agriculture is it's about a quarter of greenhouse gas emissions. And if you include all the sort of land use elements of it, you're probably looking at least a third.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, and I've been surprised on, maybe that makes me sound naive considering I write about this every 4 years, but I'm surprised that there hasn't been at least some Democrat who's coming out and saying if we're going to have this renewable fuel standard, let's reform it so that if you're going to if you're going to grow corn for the ethanol market, you're going to have to reduce your fertilizer use, because that creates not only does your nitrogen, mix with the air to create NO2, which is a very potent greenhouse gas, but it also, gets run off during a rainstorm. The nitrogen washes into rivers, and including the Mississippi River, and that's why you have these gigantic algal blooms in the Gulf and also around my home state of Florida.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you could imagine a renewable fuel standard that has some more conditions about, reducing, farming more efficiently, reducing your water use, reducing, perhaps you putting... There
like
are a whole,
cover
whole
crops
bunch of things
and,
that farmers
yeah.
can do to basically restore their soil, which is eroding. And remember, there's a lot of carbon in the soil, and it's also their future. So you can imagine kind of soil conservation and soil management requirements built into this. And you can imagine lower numbers, to be honest.
Less pressure to kind of...
It's not just an all or nothing question when it comes to the RFS. Though, again, obviously, if somebody made Mizar tomorrow, there would be, I don't think there's really a huge case at this point for
continuing
devoting
it.
Any of our corn crops to ethanol.
I don't think
anybody's going to make Mizar.
Maybe Ted Cruz, isn't he on the same page?
Well, that's another reason. Ted Cruz did. He was the one guy with the guts to go to Iowa and say, not because he's a great environmentalist.
No.
He's from Texas. He's
a big fan of oil.
The oil industry.
Yeah.
But he came down to Iowa and he said, no, I'm against it. I'm against subsidies for energy. And, you know, vote for me anyway, because I'm a real conservative. And he won Iowa. Now,
a lot
of people say that he would have won by a lot more if, you know, if
but
because,
still.
Because Iowa does tend to go for pretty right-wing Republicans in the caucus there.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, you would think that would be more evidence that coming out against, you know, being a little bit of a heretic on ethanol is not politically
A good idea. Yeah. So, I mean, it sounds like when we think about like altering the standards, that probably will get renewed. Maybe it sounds like that or continue on in some form. It sounds like a lot of the burden might fall on the farmers to make, improvements on their own land that could make the environmental footprint a little bit lighter. What do you think this means for farmers? Is this just like another policy that if we want to fix it, much like a lot of our agriculture issues, the farmers have to do all the work, basically?
Well, you know, again, I don't want to sound like a jerk about this stuff, but federal policy towards agriculture, I mean, again, it's very complicated. There are loan deficiency payments. There are crop insurance of different varieties. There are all kinds of different grant programs. There's disaster aid. There's shallow loan, you know, kind of for if you have a bad farming year. Ultimately, what it all comes down to is shoveling taxpayer dollars into farmers' pockets, or in some cases, shoveling consumer dollars into farmers' pockets. And again, there's, you know, I say that in a sort of snarky way, but remember, they do feed the country and they help
mm-hmm.
feed the world.
Mm-hmm.
And we've decided that's like a good thing to do, an important thing to have.
I like food.
And so we've made it, you know, we've taken all the risk out of farming. And we've made it quite lucrative to own a farm in America.
Certainly
the big commodity, you know,
yes.
a farm that farms the, you know, the big five
yes.
commodities, you know, the you know, a grain farmer, a rice farmer, a cotton
yeah.
farmer. And
For like a vegetable farmer, a small scale vegetable farmer, but for the commodity crops and like large scale farms, yes.
Right. And that's true. And again, to carry Big Ag's water just for a second, like, and that's not endorsing it, but this is what they would say,
mm-hmm.
Is that we have this major land problem in the world where by 2050, we're going to have to
have 10
billion people.
Yeah.
At the same time, you know, we're going to have to save a lot of land, you know, because really the only technology we've come up with for taking carbon out of the atmosphere is this thing called a tree, you know, and soils too. And so there's,
it's,
you know,
so
we're going to have to, so basically the Big Ag argument is, okay, you're going to need us because you're going to have to grow a lot of food on a smaller footprint. And that's what, you know, we do with our disgusting chemicals and our, you know, and our fertilizers you don't like.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, there are these regenerative farmers and, you know, organic farmers and conservation farmers, lots of people trying to do it differently. And there is some evidence that particularly if you give them some of the technology that the Big Ag guys have, and I don't mean the fertilizer, you know, the chemical fertilizers and chemical pesticides, but things like, you know, their irrigation methods and the way they use big data to do kind of precision agriculture,
mm-hmm.
they say that they can get the same kind of yield without having the same kind of negative effect on the soil and on the land. And I think those are going to be real questions going forward. A good climate policy would encourage agriculture, you know, which is 25 at least percent of U.S. emissions, of global emissions, you would encourage agriculture to do it in a more climate-friendly way.
Mm-hmm.
But when you talk about what federal policy is really about, it's about getting farmers their cash through higher prices or just straight-out subsidies. So I've always assumed that, you know, and you can do it in a Green New Deal, too, the way to get them to do good stuff on the climate is to essentially bribe them.
Yeah. That is not very optimistic.
Actually, it kind of is. One thing that Washington has shown that it's really good at bribing farmers.
Yeah.
If you bribe them to, you know, to help save the climate rather than bribe them just to, you know.
Or provide the tools and technology and support and technical assistance.
Cotton, yeah.
Give them tools, but that's maybe another way that we can say that, depending on who the farmer is. Okay, so if there was one policy you would like to see enacted, I'm not talking about like, but before I ask that, I just want to kind of like, where is the international community with renewable fuel standards? This is something that a lot of countries have implemented in terms of mixing ethanol, right, into their gasoline.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, Brazil has gone big on sugarcane ethanol, which, again, is like somewhat better than corn ethanol.
Why?
But it raises some of the same land use problems. Well, again, remember, there have been a bunch of studies about how, I mentioned some of them in my story, about how, you know, when after the renewable fuel standard came out, a few million acres of grasslands in the Midwest was converted to basically cornfields.
Mm-hmm.
And that's bad. But the real impact is that what the renewable fuel standard has done is essentially increase grain prices. And so I mentioned those food riots.
Yeah.
But essentially when grain prices go up, the Amazon comes down. And that's the real danger that, not just in the Midwest, but that when you make grain farming more lucrative, people are going to tear down more forests and peatlands and wetlands to do it. And then it's kind of game over for the climate, because we really need those natural carbon sinks to scoop up all those fossil fuel emissions that we've been pumping into the air for the last century.
I feel like that just about sums it up in a soundbite. the one of the major issues. Okay, so one kind of food ag policy that if you were the food czar, if only we had a food czar, that you could kind of like, you know, wave your wand and say, this is going to have a huge, like, positive impact on reducing, mitigating the effects of climate change, what would that be? Would it be ethanol?
I do think that, historically, civilizations do seem to wither when their soil withers.
Mm-hmm.
The Greeks, the Mayans, it all kind of went bad when they lost, you look at the Dust Bowl, bad stuff happens when you lose your soil. And there's a lot of carbon in that soil. It does seem that that just like we right now have a conservation reserve program that people used to make fun of as sort of paying farmers not to farm.
Mm-hmm.
There is some of that, but really what you want to pay them is not to destroy their soil. So the kind of incentives for no-till, for planting cover crops, for even diversification, and then in the meat industry, which we haven't even talked about, but obviously that's a huge part of the emissions problem.
Mm-hmm.
There seems to be different managed grazing, rotational grazing, silviculture in your graze, basically lots of ways to sort of store more carbon in your pastures and without depleting them so that you have to go cut down another forest.
Right.
I do think, and this is my general obsession on ag and food stuff that I'm may do another, may be my next book. But I do think that we sort of have to have essentially a land policy,
mm-hmm.
A policy of what are we going to do in the United States and globally so that we're not going, so that we're not going to have to tear down so many forests and that ultimately we're going to be able to regrow some forests because, the math just doesn't look good I think the current plan is if we keep going the way we're going, by 2050, we're going to have to deforest additional area twice the size of India.
Yeah.
And again, we're in a We've got to start reducing our emissions. We can't, and when deforestation is just like an emission bomb. So,
yeah. Okay.
That was maybe, I was not perhaps the most concise czar you've ever had running the country, but like, that's the kind of stuff I would do.
It's a question that, it was a trick question. Can't be concise. Okay. So for our listeners, what should we be doing? Should we be calling, you know, those who are registered Democrats and encouraging, you know, the candidates to really take a stand on the fuel standard? What do you think we should be doing?
Yeah, I do think that, I mean, you know, look, it may be too late for, since now that most of these candidates are already out, and even like Jay Inslee, who's running on biofuels, who's running on, you know, the climate as his number one issue.
Yeah.
He seems to be kind of basically saying the same thing as everybody else on biofuels. But in general, I do think that, like, pressuring candidates to be, you know, aggressive and ambitious about climate. And then, even though this has become kind of uncool, but I'm one of those people who think it also sort of matters that to try to, you know, to try to be green and advocate for green in your own lives, even though obviously policy is more important. But, you know, I do get to feel smug about my solar panels and my electric vehicle. But, like, my solar panels are like a 14% no-risk bond sitting on top of my roof. And you know, I don't know anything else that can get that kind of return.
Yeah.
And it's screwing up my utilities business model. So it's like, it really is a way they can change the world. And
yeah.
So all the kind of stuff that people say about, you know, we should eat less meat, even though I love meat and it's delicious.
Yeah,
and,
me too. It's 100% true.
And
it's so important.
But, you know, I'm trying to eat less, and I'm trying to eat Impossible Burgers and Beyond Burgers and that stuff. And I cheat and I feel bad about it, but less is better.
Mm-hmm.
And, so, you know,
doing what you can do personally.
I don't laugh at that stuff. I think a lot of policy journalists do, but I don't.
No, it is. You know, I've been talking a lot about environmental issues, especially in the past, you know, with all of these kind of climate change reports. And I cannot have a conversation without talking about the importance of reducing meat consumption. And, like, everyone's saying it, so maybe we should start listening and actually doing that. And, you know, I'm in Brooklyn, so we're all about doing everything that we can, you know. Plastic water bottles here.
And, you know, and not to get off my soapbox a little bit, but it really is, like, beef is, like, 10 times worse than chicken.
Definitely.
And that we kind of know. Now, there's no, like, for when you're just talking about the climate, like the sort of organic, nice beef that they, you know, they let the cows run free or whatever, or treat them really nice.
Mm-hmm.
There doesn't seem to be a lot of evidence that that's necessarily better for the climate than the evil big ag beef. Although, you know, there may be other reasons to do it. But less beef, you know, more chicken, more, and obviously more plants.
That's based diet.
That's
yeah.
a proven climate solution.
Right. Okay. So to one, we have to wrap up, but, like, I just want to know, as, you know, a journalist, an author, especially who's written a lot about the environment, who are your go-to sources where, you know, kind of like leaders in the field, academics, other journalists that you turn to that you, like, really keep an eye on in terms of the work they're doing for, like, trends and what we should be knowing about?
Oh, wow. You're asking
where do you get your information? Yeah.
I mean, yes, yeah. You know, I'm not sure I have any, like, you know, you mentioned Tim Searchinger, who's been a great source of mine for 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, before he even knew about climate change, before either one of us basically ever even heard of climate change, you know, we were working together on wetland stories and the Army Corps of Engineers.
Oh, wow.
I think, you know, any story I do, I try to talk to everybody.
Yeah.
And I try to keep an open mind. And that's why, like I said, like, I'm fascinated by these food and ag issues. And I'm completely convinced, for example, that, you know, that meat has become a real problem that we're going to have to do something about. But I really don't know, you know, so I'm trying to figure this out, I'm sure, with a lot of your listeners, mm-hmm. You know, whether the answer lies with, you know, whether it's a more regenerative type of agriculture or whether it's just like tough, we're just all going to have to stop eating less beef, or, you know, God forbid, you know, the poor countries are going to not be able to follow the gluttonous lifestyles that we have.
They won't be able to, and they're going to be hit first and hardest.
It's very, you know, I think I'm kind of reaching out to everyone who's involved in it, including the industry, because it's always interesting to talk to them. And they, you know, it's like, even though obviously they're not going to face any pressure from this administration, they know that.
Well, consumer, you know, pressure.
Things are going to have to change.
Yeah, they face a lot of consumer pressure. That's like been really instrumental in helping them kind of move, you know, like pivot in some cases. And I am a big believer in the, you know, the opportunities that we can, that, you know, that the public sector or the private sector can offer in terms of making changes. So,
And it's an exciting time. There's like, you know, I know a lot of, probably especially in Brooklyn, but a lot of people are really freaked out about sort of the intersection of technology and food.
Yeah.
But since I got two kids, and I think a lot about, like, you know, climate is my issue. I feel like, you know, we gotta fix that. And there's a lot of, you know, in the same way that we've sort of screwed up our soil in the 20th century, and screwed up so many things with chemistry. There are some really exciting possibilities about trying to fix some of that stuff in the 21st century with biology. You know, we'll see. Like, you know, we invented really nasty fertilizers, but now people are trying to, you know, they've mapped the genome of various microbes that you can put on plants so that they don't need fertilizers. So, you know, you can imagine trying to reverse some of the damage through technology in ways that that probably make some people queasy. But I'm more queasy about,
not doing anything.
Planet being destroyed, because like it's a super cool planet, and like I don't know any other planets that have pizza and ice cream. So, you know,
well, we
should try to save it.
We should definitely try to save it, especially since I'm literally sitting in a pizza parlor. I guess if you would call Roberta's a parlor, it's definitely a restaurant. Okay, so where can our listeners find a copy of your book that's already out, and can I get first dibs on interviewing you when you write your book on land policy? Two-part question.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, I'm just sort of starting to poke around, but yeah, no, the Swamp and the New Deal are both available, you know, on Amazon or, you know,
wherever books are sold.
That's probably the best place to get it, since they're, you know, they're not super new.
Yeah.
But, and then my, you know, my magazine work is in Politico, and I, you know, sound off on Twitter at Mike Grunwald. I'm not hard to find.
All right. Awesome. Well, we will definitely find you there. Michael, thank you so much for coming on the show and unpacking this complicated and really important issue with us.
Anytime. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. Okay. I want to give a big thanks to our sponsors for their generous support, as well as our engineer, Jeet Paul. Show music is by Tim Archer. All episodes of Eating Matters are available on the Heritage Radio website or as a podcast, wherever podcasts are found. I'm Jenna Liut, and thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat & 3 is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah. And my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.